This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. Step inside and find out what you need to know about the issues that matter from people who really know what they're talking about. And you can subscribe to the podcast via BBC Sounds. If the programme works for you, and particularly if it doesn't, and you know how possibly it could, tell us what you think by writing a review or rating us on your podcast provider. This week, we're talking about climate change, and I'll be speaking to Lord Nicholas Stern, who, back in 2006, was author of the very influential Stern Review on Climate Change. And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds.
Right now, we're facing a man-made disaster of global scale. Our greatest threat in thousands of years, climate change.
Arguably, it's the most important story of them all. In October, the IPCC, that's the UN body that reports on climate change, issued a report that concluded that if humanity wants to avoid catastrophic environmental damage, then we need to reduce carbon emissions by almost half in the next 12 years. 12. And that would mean, and I quote, rapid, far-reaching and unprecedented changes in all aspects of society. What things would we have to do? And what are the chances of us doing them? It's a huge subject, but you can make a start here with me in the briefing room. First, a word about our assumptions. This programme is predicated on the acceptance that the international scientific consensus on climate change and its causes is more likely than not to be correct. Just so you know. First, we're going to get a brief history of climate change from Professor Mark Maslin. He's a climatologist at University College London. The latest round of talks took place last week in Katowice in Poland. But how did we get there?
In June 1988, there's a seminal moment in climate change when Jim Hansen, an academic at NASA, sat in front of Congress and stated, global warming is happening and here is the data and we need to do something about it.
The greenhouse effect is already large enough to begin to affect the probability of extreme events such as summer heat waves.
And what's interesting, only a year later, in 1989, Margaret Thatcher stands in front of the UN and actually states that climate change is the major issue for our generation and we as an international group of countries should do something about it.
The problem of global climate change is one that affects us all, and action will only be effective if it's taken at the international level.
The really interesting thing about Margaret Thatcher's speech is she actually uses the term climate change, which is probably about 10 to 15 years ahead of its time, because up to that point and into the early 90s, most of us were still talking about just global warming. In 1989, the UN and the World Meteorological Organization set up the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The reason for this was to try to bring together all the evidence about global warming into one major report. The first one of these was published incredibly quickly in 1990. In 1997, the politics of climate change had reached a peak and the Kyoto Protocol was agreed and ratified in 2001. Interesting thing about the Kyoto Protocol, it was a legally binding international treaty with actual cuts in emissions for all the developed countries. the key piece of legislation in the Kyoto Protocol is the actual cuts in carbon emissions agreed for every single developed country. This was a seminal moment because it showed the international community had understood the science of climate change and realized that major cuts in our emissions had to be made. There are a few moments in the climate change story where you can see the whole world shifting. In 2006, Sir Nicholas Stern, who at the time was a leading economist in the UK Treasury Department, produced his report on the economics of climate change.
I'm optimistic, having done this review, that we have the time and knowledge to act, but only if we act internationally, strongly and urgently.
This was a game changer, because up to that moment in time, the climate change agenda was all about the environment, environmental damage, and what Nicholas did was actually turn around and say, this will cost you money. This will cost you a huge amount of money in the future if you don't deal with it now. The UK can be very proud of itself because in 2008, the government put through the UK Climate Change Act. And this mandates the government to cut UK greenhouse emissions by about 80% of their 1990 levels by 2050.
This will make us the first country in the world to enshrine in law binding climate change targets and stretching and ambitious targets, and they need to be so, 80% by 2050. And I think they provide a scale of ambition, Mr. Speaker, which will enable us to play our part with authority in seeking a global agreement at Copenhagen at the end of next year.
By 2009, the excitement about climate change and the international community's response to it was at its height. Now, every year, there was a huge meeting to negotiate climate change called the COP meetings, and that means the Conference of the Parties. This year, it was going to be at Copenhagen, and the great thing was that there were going to be binding targets that built on Kyoto. However, it followed the financial crash in 2008, and it went all horribly wrong. The interesting thing is the American administration undermined the whole process to get away from legal binding targets to non-binding pledges.
It leaves me very, very disappointed, and I feel that the international community has simply not risen up to the challenge.
The only thing that came out of Copenhagen was the international community agreed that they should try to keep climate change to only 2 degrees. The damage that was done in Copenhagen took 6 years to repair. But in 2015, in Paris, a new agreement was actually produced. This pledged to limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, but also slipped in there that if possible, then the international community would try to limit climate change to 1.5 degrees. Now, this was a major step forward. We now actually have a proper climate change agreement, which is continually negotiated every single year. 2018 has been an exciting year in the politics of climate change. Firstly, on the 1st of June, President Trump announces the US will withdraw from the Paris Agreement, even though it doesn't have legally binding targets.
In order to fulfill my solemn duty to protect America and its citizens, the United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord. I was elected to represent the citizens of Pittsburgh, not Paris.
And then later in the year, the IPCC brought out its 1.5 degree report. This is a seminal report. What is clear is that the Paris Agreement does not go far enough. The interesting thing about the Paris Agreement is if all the current pledges are actually achieved by all the countries of the world, that might get us down to 3.5 degrees warming by the end of the century. So it's a stark contrast between the politics and the science. The science says we must actually do a lot more as a global community to try and get down to 2 degrees or even 1.5 degrees, whereas the pledges, non-legally binding pledges by countries, don't get us anywhere near that at this moment.
Professor Mark Maslin, the single country responsible for the largest emissions of carbon dioxide is China. So I invited Isabel Hilton into the briefing room. She's the editor of China Dialogue, a website that focuses on what it calls China's urgent environmental challenges. Isabel Hilton, how important is China in the world of climate change? And I guess what I mean by that is, how much does it contribute to carbon emissions, and how influential is its stance in policy terms?
It's huge in both. Since 2005, China has been the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gases. If China is not signed up to whatever the world decides to do about climate change, it's not going to work. And there has been an evolution of China's position between, for example, Copenhagen and Paris, which has been very important. So China is now a committed party. It was a committed party in the Kyoto Protocol, but it was what was called a non-Annex One country. So it was not obliged legally to take action, only within its capabilities. China then was a relatively small economy. Then it became the world's second largest economy and the world's biggest emitter. And it moved from being, you know, poor us, we're just a poor developing country, to a major player.
Well, that's a very good point, because I seem to recall back in the day, there was the argument that, look, you America, you Europe developed, making all these emissions. Now you're telling us to cut back. Well, that's not fair. What you're suggesting is that they might still have a kind of element of thinking that, but that that doesn't solve the forward problem, and they now want to do that.
They understand the basic science, and they did a lot of education of the Central Committee and of the Politburo about the dangers of climate change. They realised that climate change was a huge threat to China, but they also, because of where they were in their industrial development, understood that the next phase of China's growth was going to have to come from higher technologies, not just the cheap manufacture that had driven it up till then. And they thought, well, the higher technologies are going to be low carbon technologies if climate change is going to be something the world takes seriously. So they positioned themselves to be the leading supplier and manufacturer of low carbon technologies. So if you look at the economic plan at that time, you can see the strategy absolutely laid out. So China moves from being an obstacle, if you like, to being a leader in facilitating the means by which the world might tackle climate change.
Why does China feel itself to be uniquely vulnerable to climate change?
China has very little ecological headroom. It's got one-fifth of the world's population crammed onto a territory the size of the United States. It has a very low per capita allocation of fresh water. Its major cities are all low-lying. If you think of Guangzhou and Shanghai and Tianjin, they're all delta cities. Sea level rise is a serious issue, and all that development down the East Coast is at risk. So they're really on a knife edge in all sorts of ways in terms of the ecosystems that support the economy. And climate change could tip them over.
Let's be blunt about this. Is it also because it's not actually a country that needs to listen too closely to sections of its public when doing things like closing down coal mines and so on?
There's a certain truth in that, but it tends to be exaggerated. You know, the Communist Party, like every other government, lasts longer if it governs with some form of the consent of its people, even if that consent isn't expressed through the ballot box. And the Communist Party is extremely careful about social unrest. Closing down sunset industries is a risky thing to do in any country. And one of the reasons that China still is burning a lot of coal is because they have many millions of people engaged in the coal industry. And in China, it's not that there are no politics in China, it's just that they're all within the party. So you do have vested interests in China. You do have a heavy carbon industry. You do have a cement and a steel industry. And all of those are resisting, of course, being shut down. And they tend to be exported now.
Now, the latest IPCC report suggests that actually we've got to go beyond Paris. Will China sign up for going beyond Paris and for further reduction of emission?
China's certainly very committed to the Paris process. They've said so explicitly after the United States announced that it was going to withdraw. China was quite unhappy in Paris at the emergence of 1.5 as a target because they hadn't really prepared for it. And China set targets at Paris, which are very loose. They promised to peak their emissions at 2030. They could probably do it by 2022, but they like to under-promise and over-fulfill in the Chinese system. So I think we should have no doubt that they will meet their targets. The question is, how much are they prepared to ratchet up their targets? And I think one factor in that is it's unfortunate that the US pressure has been taken off, because the relationship between Obama and Xi Jinping, which was established 2 years before Paris on climate science, was very important. And it turned an antagonistic relationship, one of mutual blame, into one of cooperation. And we've lost that.
Isabel Hilton. Now, as we've already heard, President Trump has announced his intention to withdraw the United States from the Paris Agreement. Is that the end of the story of US efforts to prevent catastrophic climate change? Joining me now in the briefing room is Julia Steinberger, an associate professor at the Center for Climate Change Economics and Policy at Leeds University. Julia Steinberger, how did President Trump's withdrawal from the Paris Agreement affect the chances of implementing international agreements on climate change, do you think?
I think there are two different dimensions of this. One is that Trump's withdrawal from Paris means that the U.S. is not playing an international leadership role in trying to move the climate change agenda forward. At Katowice, the U.S. refused to welcome the science, which many, many American scientists participated in, which is the IPCC special report on 1.5 degrees. So the U.S. stood alongside petrostates like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Russia as one of four countries refusing to welcome the scientific evidence on the dire impacts of climate change that are really happening, that we're really seeing happen right now. In terms of the effect on emissions, it might not be as drastic as all that, because there's a lot of resistance within the United States. So in terms of the U.S. having climate commissions in terms of reducing emissions, those emissions might actually be reduced because of several factors coming together. However, the real problem is that Trump is opening new lands for fossil fuel exploration. He's promoting the fossil fuel industry through subsidies. He's reducing regulations on cars. So he's doing all kinds of damage nationally and internationally. However, his effect on the U.S. specific commitments might not be that big.
So what kind of thing are we talking about? You're talking about future mining of what? Of more coal or of future exploration for more oil in places that where it hasn't been before?
It's mainly oil and gas. So coal is going down no matter what Trump is doing because it's not competitive economically anymore. So there is this long-term trend of decline in coal. But he is increasing gas and oil exploration immensely. And so he's opened up huge amounts of federal public lands for gas and oil exploration. They've just been being auctioned off. So that's something we are not yet seeing the effects of. The other thing is, obviously, without his intervention, the U.S. might be on track to reduce emissions even more. So their emissions increased by 3% last year, mainly due to climatic factors. It was very hot summer, very cold winter, and that drove up energy use. But for instance, with more stringent automobile regulations that he's rolled back, the emissions could go down even further. So his effect is definitely negative. It's just he can't change some long-term trends. He can't change the actions of the states and the cities that are opposed to his agenda.
Can you give a couple of examples of what those states and cities are actually concretely doing?
In some cases, they have extremely ambitious plans. There's a group called Climate Cities, and they're also climate states, effectively. They're committing to things like decarbonizing, going to 100% renewable energy in a reasonably short time span. So, for instance, New York State announced that they will have a goal of going to 0% carbon emissions in their electricity sector by 2040. Minneapolis is basically building a blueprint, a very ambitious blueprint, for a car-free city, effectively. They're trying to remove parking spaces. They're trying to make neighborhoods that are really not dominated by car use anymore.
How far can states do what they like without federal say-so when it comes to carbon policies?
They have a huge amount of freedom. So the U.S. is a federation, and that means that the states are the largest location of independence. They have their own budget. they're very, very big. So they have their own economies effectively. And one of the things they want to do is they want to build their own economies on a basis of a reasonable climate future. So the other thing is that a lot of the states are seeing direct threats from climate change, which is something that wasn't even true just a couple of years ago. We're really seeing the impacts of climate change and the fingerprints of climate change in hurricanes and fires and droughts and floods. This is becoming obvious to everybody. And so the states have a large responsibility to protect their own population, and that's one of the things they want to do here.
One of the things that Isabel Hilton told us was that China is getting a significant number of new jobs in the fields of renewables and low energy intensive industries, and that this is an important part of its future. How far does the prospect of something like that mitigate against the loss in America of old jobs linked to old emitting industries?
I think this is seen as a huge opportunity in America. And I think already at the time when Trump was trying to revive the coal industry, people were pointing out this is absurd because there are actually already more jobs, for instance, just in the solar industry in the U.S. But what we're seeing is a struggle that's playing out across the world between incumbent industries that are extremely strong and that are to some extent inside the walls of government because they have direct links to ministries on road building, on extraction, on job topics, on different things. And the new industries and the new generation that really sees the need for change because they are at risk. They see themselves as being completely threatened.
Julia Steinberger. That's China and the USA. So post-Katowice, where does this leave the rest of us at the end of 2018? As we heard earlier, Professor Lord Nicholas Stern wrote a seminal report back in 2006, The Stern Review by name and The Stern Review by nature, given the warnings it contained. He joins me now in the briefing room. Nick Stern, how serious is the situation we're in now based on the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report?
We should start with the 1 degree centigrade we are already above the end of the 19th century, which is our usual benchmark. That's average global surface temperature. And we are already seeing very difficult events, fires, heavy hurricanes and storms and cyclones and so on. We are going to get close to, or we risk going beyond, the 1.5 degrees, which was the subject of the recent report of the IPCC. And what that report did is it compared 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees and showed that the difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees in terms of impacts on the planet and species and humankind was really rather severe. So the answer is at 1 degree now, we're already experiencing great difficulties. We're headed for 3 degrees if you take the Paris commitments for 2030, and 3 degrees we haven't seen for 3 million years or so, way, way out of the experience of Homo sapiens. The sea levels would have been many meters higher. And if we got to 3 degrees and beyond, as we're headed for at the moment on current paths, that would mean hundreds of millions, probably billions, having to move. And that would likely result in severe extended conflict, and you couldn't make a peace treaty with the environment.
Now, what level of emission would we have to cut back in order to get to 2030 to 1.5, the highest tolerable figure of increase?
Well, the 1.5 degree would require us to cut our emissions by around a half if we wanted to stay well below 2 degrees, which is the Paris target. That Paris target's well below 2 degrees with the best efforts for 1.5. We would have to cut by something like 25 or 30% or more. So that's very radical change. But the good news is that we've got the technologies that can do that. We'll have to invest strongly. We'll have to invest purposefully from now on, but we would have investments with really attractive returns, cities where you can move and breathe, indeed, in many cases, producing costs which are much lower under the sort of old fossil fuel Earth-based system. So we have to act very strongly, and that from now on. But actually, those are investments which are extremely attractive, not simply from reducing the risks of climate change, but also much better way of producing and consuming.
In that case, why haven't we done it already? In other words, what's been stopping us making the changes to the forms of attractive technologies that you actually have been talking about for well over a decade?
The arrival of those technologies has accelerated. The costs of solar with storage, the cost of wind with storage, has plummeted in the last 10 or 15 years. So one of the reasons we haven't done it, David, is that these technologies have come through so quickly, but we have them now. But a second reason is the power of vested interests, and that we are not as societies terribly good at managing rapid change. I think also that we've been diverted politically, including by the global financial crisis.
By vested interests, what are we talking about there? Are we talking just about companies with lobbyists, or are we talking about large numbers of workers and people dependent upon industries which are high emission?
I think it's both. You've seen very intense lobbying by people like the Koch brothers and past ExxonMobil and so on as oil companies. You see in Australia very strong vested interest in the coal mining industries. So part of it is the fossil fuel interests themselves. There are also going to have to be major changes in transport. So you have car firms which are locked into the old internal combustion engine technologies, and they put pressure on their politicians, for example. But you've also got people, and we have to manage change much better than we have done in the past, because people will have to move out of some industries, such as coal mining. And the challenge then is to find other ways in which they can acquire new skills and work in different ways.
How much do you think, roughly, it would cost economically and politically to implement the necessary changes to encourage the kinds of changes which will get us up to the sorts of figures for emissions that we're going to need?
I would now talk about investments rather than costs, because what's happened, as we were discussing a little earlier, is technology has changed so dramatically in the meantime that these different ways of doing things are actually now, in many cases around the world, cheaper than the old-fashioned high fossil fuel ways of doing things. So now I think that we have a growth story in our hands, an inclusive growth story, which is sustainable, much more attractive, has involved cities where we can move and breathe and be productive. So I prefer to rephrase it, David, in terms of what kinds of extra investment do we have to make? And I would suggest probably 1-2% of GDP over the coming years. And that is a story which is extremely attractive. It's a story of investment and innovation rather than a narrow story of cost.
And to summarise what you're saying, in the past, sometimes movements for environmental preservation have seemed quite hair-shirted. What they've essentially said is, you've got to stop growing and you've got to have less. Your message seems to be, well, actually, you don't have to. You just have to grow in a different way and in a cleaner way, and we can do it.
Yes, we can. We have to simply break the relationship between economic activity and the pollution and damage and effects on climate change through emissions. And we know how to do that now. And it tackles air pollution at the same time. All that now is in our hands as a result of the extraordinary technical progress we've seen in the last 15 years or so. But also remember that so much more is coming. We've got that technical progress on the back of pretty mediocre policies. Imagine if we had clear and strong policies, how fast that would be.
I'm going to ask you a really horrible question. You've obviously said we can get there. We can. Do you think we will?
I'm very optimistic about what we can do and how attractive it is. Whether we will do it depends on people like you and me, David. It's our job to analyse, to think, to talk, to communicate. So we have to have public discussion, leadership, to change the understanding and to change the politics. Only in this way will we get the political will to take action on the urgency and scale we need.
Nicholas Stern there, and if you have to sum that up, I suppose you'd say, well, it's doable, just starting now. My thanks to him, to Mark Maslin, to Isabel Hilton and Julia Steinberger. We're back on air in January. Until then, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Tim Mansell, Serena Tarling and Tom Hill. And you can subscribe to this podcast via BBC Sounds, and you can let us know what you think about it by writing a review or rating us on your podcast provider.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.